Welcome to the UK Investor Magazine podcast, the latest on shares, markets and investments, now available on your Amazon Alexa.
Hello and welcome to the UK Investor Magazine podcast, now also available on the UK Investor Magazine mobile app. For today's podcast, we're going to be taking a deep dive into FTSE 250 listed Grainger. We're going to be looking at recent developments at the company. We're also going to be looking at the outlook for the year ahead. And to do that, we're very kindly joined today by Robert Hudson, who is the Chief Financial Officer of Grainger. Robert, thank you very much for being on the podcast today.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here and lovely to meet you, Jonathan.
Likewise, great to meet you. I'm really looking forward to this conversation. It's a fascinating sector and there's lots going on at the moment. So before we get into it, Robert, it would be good if you could give us, first of all, an introduction to yourself as well as Grainger for those that may not be aware of the company.
Yeah, sure. So I'm Rob Hudson. I'm the CFO of Grainger. I've been with Grainger for just under 4 years now. And before that, I've been working in real estate for the last 14 years across actually most of the subsectors in real estate. And way before that, I spent 11 years at Experian, where most latterly I was the CFO for the UK arm of Experian. But it really is a fantastic time to be at Grainger because we're going through such a great growth trajectory and there's a huge amount of momentum in the business.
Indeed, and we're going to be talking about some of that growth later on in the podcast. But I think a good place to start be, Robert, and it's looking at the transition from a trading business to a REIT. So that looks really interesting. What was the thinking behind this and what are the actual benefits for investors in Grainger becoming a REIT?
Yeah, sure. So just to start off with Grainger, we are the UK's largest listed residential landlord, and we have a very significant and growing portfolio. So we have over 11,000 homes. These are all throughout the UK. So we're present across London and most of the major cities in the UK. And I'm sure we can talk a little bit more later about that as well. And particularly excitingly, we have a pipeline of just under 5,000 homes. So we've got this fantastic growth momentum, both in terms of our top line, but also with our earnings accelerating even more because we've got a fantastic platform, which is driving a lot of efficiency in the business. And we've embarked on this strategy back in 2016 when our CEO, Helen Gordon, joined the business. And Grainger has always been focused on residential activities. We actually have a very long history. We were formed in 1912 up in Newcastle. And since then, we've obviously grown to be a very large FTSE business. So we had a strategic repositioning and a focus particularly away from the legacy trading business, which is reducing naturally over time with the regulated tenancies because they stopped being made in the 1980s when the regulation ceased. And then we saw this huge opportunity to grow into to build to rent. And as a professional sector, these are, you know, modern purpose designed buildings to be rented, coming with in-house resident services teams, co-working facilities, residence lounges, gyms, outdoor space. And this professionalized sector is only 2% of the rental market. So we're only a tiny slither of a growing market. So the opportunity is huge. So just fast forward to today, we're 9 years now into the execution of the strategy, and a big strategic milestone of that strategy is converting into a REIT. And we've got very clear visibility over our plans to deliver that, and we will be converting ready for the start of that FY26, which is the start of October 2025. So we're less than 6 months away now from converting to a REIT. We're incredibly excited about it. It basically means the majority of the business now sits in build to rent as opposed to the legacy regulated tenancies, which means we can convert to a REIT. And from an investor point of view, I think it's a particularly exciting time to be looking at Grainger because converting to a REIT also means that equalizes any tax differences. And for us, meaning that in practice, that eliminates corporation tax on our build-to-rent portfolio. So effectively, as an investor, you're taxed on your dividend income from Grainger, just once in your hands as opposed to at the corporate level as well. And interestingly, I'm sure we can come on to discuss this more, many individual buy-to-let investors, which are the vast majority, that's 98% of the market, the accidental landlords, if you like, with a lot of changes coming down the line with regulation and government standards, we are very well placed as a modern corporate business to meet these standards. And becoming a REIT means for the small retail investors, you can invest in Grainger as an alternative to having an individual buy-to-let home. And you could even consider putting your Grainger shares, of course, into an ISA, which means it would be completely tax-free. So a pretty exciting time, both in terms of the business and converting to a REIT from an investor point of view.
That's a really interesting point that you make there, Rob, about retail investors that may be looking at their own buy-to-let properties, considering Grainger, because you have all of the market dynamics behind it. But as you say, if you're able to put it into an ISA, there's huge tax benefits there. So that's a really interesting point. Going back to the transition to a REIT, I just want to look at the operations and what it actually means, and if there are indeed going to be any changes for Grainger in terms of your underlying operations, construction of houses. You've got a pretty significant pipeline that we'll discuss in more detail later on. So, what does it mean operationally? I'm sure that's something investors would be interested to hear a little bit more about, what it means for Grainger on the ground.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a great question, Jonathan. And from a pure operational point of view, we made the decision when we embarked on this strategy, we wanted to be leading the sector in terms of technology and our platform and how we did things and really designing the business ready to be scaled. And how we went about that was through our Connect operating platforms. This is the technology which supports all of the business. Very simply, it's digitized the whole of the customer journey from initial acquisition to then onboarding and day-to-day management. And what that means in practice is that it's made us very efficient and scalable. So as we go through this very rapid growth, it means we're not having to add lots of central overhead to the business. So actually, if you track back over many years, we're growing the overhead just in line with wage inflation. So in terms of real growth, we're holding those overheads flat. Whereas the top line is inflating incredibly rapidly as we have good organic growth, and obviously we're growing through developments as well. So we have the technology in place. It is scalable. Actually, our platform has been designed to hold many, many more homes. It's very, very robust. And it also improves the customer experience as well, meaning, if you're a customer, you've got access to the My Grainger app. You can report if you have a repair needed doing, for example. You can report and book in through the app and see availability and so on. So the business has been designed to be scalable. We have the other thing which really differentiates Grainger, because we have there are other players in the sector, most of them privately held by long-term patient capital. So the insurance funds, sovereign wealth, for example, are all holders of the sector, as they see it as a very attractive sector to be in. Many actually outsource their activities to third-party managing agents, meaning two things really. One, we're more efficient and cost effective because you often pay away several percent of your income for these activities to be managed by third party providers. And of course, you're disaggregating the customer relationship, meaning that the customer journey in practice can vary, for example, through leasing. If you're using many estate agents all from around the country, you're not necessarily going to have that same goal alignment and the very intimate and deep knowledge that we have of our buildings and that customer journey. So it makes us, from an operational point of view, again, not a huge amount of change in terms of how we operate, because we have the people, we have the processes in place, and most importantly, the culture. So we have our Grainger way of doing things. We're very focused on our customer service style. Everyone in the business has been trained on that, from myself and Helen, our CEO, right down to everybody on our front of house staff. So very few activities are actually outsourced. We have a good supply chain. And actually, the biggest implication for us of scale is is really driving further efficiency through the business, because as we build size in cities, it means we can then share management resources as well. So, for example, you know, Bristol, where we're building a cluster there, we have one general manager, we have teams underneath, but effectively that becomes more and more efficient. So we don't have to add the same amount of management heads as we scale up. So the biggest operational implication is actually just driving efficiency through the operating leverage, which is inherent in our business. And our margins are growing very rapidly as a result of that. We're actually moving from 54% EBITDA margin last financial year, and over the next 5 years, just from scaling up from the pipeline which we've got on site, so that's all de-risked, is actually going to take our margins to over 60%. So it gives you a sense of how we're really driving profitability and then accelerating it over and above the rental growth. From a development perspective, because I know that's one of the other areas you were touching on as well, we actually have got a great and very well-established sourcing team for opportunities. You know, many have entered the sector and wanted to build portfolios of thousands of homes, because we're all on this journey to build scale and efficiency and improved customer experience, which comes from being a, you know, bigger business with developed processes. But actually, most in the sector have not been able to achieve the scale. We are the largest player in the marketplace. In fact, the vast majority of players have got a portfolio of just in the hundreds to low thousands. So the way we've done that is through sourcing schemes, not only through joint ventures such as our Transport for London, which is where we're managing the developments. We've got a great in-house development team led by our development director, Mark Keveney, and we also source through acquisitions. And then we also source through what we call forward fund development arrangements. This is where we're not directly developing. We actually work through third-party developers, and we have a good network there. And then opportunities are brought to us, which we evaluate, and then effectively we lay off the development risk to them. But we have a standard Grainger way of developing and specification that we put into these buildings, so which is built up through many years of deep research and understanding from our customers and feedback they give us around how they live and use our space. So we can really drive efficiencies there. An example might be in terms of development, actually, is within the apartments themselves. We often make choices of thinking about product life cycle costings. So that means often we'll put in, you know, more expensive elements such as, you know, Amteco flooring in our apartments, because we know that they're durable, and our data still tells us that they stand the test of time. You know, these products will last for, you know, many years into decades. And therefore will be much more efficient than having to replace carpets, for example, every year if you know, coffee gets spilled in them or whatever. So we're using our, you know, using the life cycle of acquiring, developing, operating, and it's a continuous cycle of feedback where we're always looking to improve what we do.
Thank you, Rob. Really interesting to hear about the detail that you go in when you're building your portfolio, and that's something that I'd like to talk about in more detail now, because you mentioned that you have a pipeline of 5,000 properties, and that's a significant increase on the 11,000 that you're currently operating. So I'd like to drill down into that and look at, you know, where these properties may be, how you go about selecting certain geographies, you know, the types of properties as well. If you give us some insight into how you're going about delivering that pipeline and where you see it being deployed across the country.
Yes, yeah. So the portfolio today is roughly equally divided between London and the South East, and then the major cities throughout the UK. And our pipeline actually mirrors that kind of balance going forward. So we've in terms of our investment criteria, we're incredibly disciplined, and we've got an in-house research team, and we go down to the local authority level in terms of the depth of our analysis. So we've actually analysed 58 cities throughout the UK from this, which equates to over 300 local authorities. So we go down to that level of detail, and we rank them on six success factors. And that's driven through 22 different economic and demographic data sets. So we look at, for example, at employment and the demographic projected growth trends. We look at supply factors into these cities as well. So we do some very detailed individual analysis on each city, and then we rank according to attractiveness. And so that's resulted as in building in investments up. Not obviously, London is a fantastic rental city, and it's naturally constrained in terms of supply, and obviously demand remains very, very strong. But it's equally the case for many of the major cities all around the UK, Birmingham, Manchester. We're incredibly proud that we've just entered Oxford. We're the first build-to-rent operator in Oxford, which has been an incredibly hard city to source schemes in because of the nature of the city. And lease up there is growing incredibly well. We launched back in January. Bristol again. So all of these major cities have been incredibly attractive. And when we look at the performance over many years across these cities, they all have fantastic rental growth, really strong occupancy and demand. We often have waiting lists for many of our buildings. These are all really favourable cities to invest in.
Thank you. So in terms of going down another layer, Robert, and actually looking at the individual properties, what do these look like? Are they mostly flats? Do you have a mix of flats and houses? Are they one beds, two beds? Do you have when you're setting out and building the portfolio, do you have a market value in mind that you wouldn't go across? Obviously, taking into consideration, build costs and where they're located. It'd be good to get a little bit more detail on what an individual property could look like.
Yes. Yeah, that's a great question, Jonathan. So when we look across the portfolio, we do have quite a variety, actually. But probably the first thing to say is we do single family housing. So, individual houses. We focus on London and the southeast as an area. And the reason for that is that we're particularly focused on areas where affordability to buy a home is stretched, and therefore obviously that really underpins rental demand. So we're very disciplined in terms of our investment decisions, and we've said no more than 10% of the portfolio would be in single family housing. Although of course we always keep these things under review. So that means in practice the majority of the portfolio sits in apartment blocks. These typically range in size from around 150 units to 600 units. And we like operating at that kind of level because, we obviously need to have a certain level of scale to drive efficiencies and to support the local resident services teams that we put in. Equally, if we go extremely large, sort of 1,000 units plus, then sometimes it can be difficult to maintain rental tension because you'll have a certain level of vacancy, and obviously customers can see that when they're choosing where to live. So that's for us is our sweet spot, but of course we would always have a little bit of flexibility around that. And then we look to drive efficiency from that in cities by building up clusters. So this is where we'll often have it's many schemes in a particular city, and we're building up scaling in each of these cities to well over 1,000 units, and then of course that really drives management efficiency and also increases our buying power for procurements as well, further driving down margins as well where we outsource certain things like repairs and maintenance and facilities management. So yes, that sort of gives a bit of a sense. Now, interestingly, I look back to when I first joined Grainger. The other thing to mention is that we're focused on the mid-market, which is obviously where the deepest part of the rental demand is within the UK. We build homes ultimately which are affordable for local people, and 25% of our customers actually work in the public sector or associated key worker type roles. So we're not so much at the luxury end, we're at the more sort of resilient deep mid-market end. But when you walk into our properties, and I'm sure many people listening to this podcast will take a look at our website, and you can see all the fantastic pictures of our product. So I'd done all my research before I joined Grainger, but actually walking into some of the buildings for the first time was quite eye-opening, because it really feels, you know, the quality is very evident, and it feels, you know, a fantastic experience, almost, you know, akin to being in a sort of, you know, a really lovely boutique hotel. This is a mid-market product, so I think the value for money from a customer point of view is absolutely fantastic, because we peg our rents and very closely to local market rents. And on the other hand, when a customer moves into a Grainger property, what you're getting is a modern, you know, recently built post 2016, so it has all the safety aspects built in. Our portfolio is 95% EPC A to C, unlike the rest of the market, which is closer to 50%, and in fact most are A's and B's. So, you know, very energy efficient apartments, which obviously save our customers money in these times of higher energy costs, and you get all these extra services included. So the super fast Wi-Fi is included, your gym is included, access to co-working space and residence lounges is all included within your base rent. So it's a great value proposition.
It is very much catering to the modern residential needs. So that's really interesting. So I'd like to drill down into some of the numbers now, Rob. Looking at a recent trading update, total rental growth was up 15%.
Yes. Now,
what does this look like going forward in terms of new properties coming online? Is it being driven by rental growth? What's the mix there?
Yeah, so it's, it's, I often say to Helen, it's such a joy to be the CFO of this business, because we keep putting out great numbers and we're going through such strong growth. And we've got a huge amount of growth locked in. So we're not only delivering really strong top line growth and bottom line growth. So, you know, 15% rental growth is, as you say, for the first 4 months of this financial year, FY25. But when you look at our pipeline, the pipeline that we've amassed, that we talked to earlier, has actually got the ability to double the rent when compared with FY23. And this is not just all, you know, rent for the future. We have a really nice continuous growth being delivered as each new scheme lands and continues to grow. So if we look just at the current financial year, there's 13 million of rent being added from the schemes which have either recently completed or completing this year. And that plays against our reported rents of 110 million. So you can see from that, you know, we've got very strong growth. This is what's driving the largest part of the 15% of our rental growth. The next 2 years, we have 9 million locked in from our pipeline. So, you know, every year we've got, you know, strong, very strong rental growth coming through. The momentum is really accelerating within the business. So that's fantastic. And organic underlying rental growth, we say on that, on top of this pipeline rent which is being delivered, you can typically expect from Grainger, if you look back over sort of decades, the underlying rate of growth is usually slightly ahead of general inflation. And that's because our customers' wage inflation, which supports obviously rental growth, it tends to be a little bit higher than general inflation. Most of my customers are in the 25 to 40 type bracket when they're going through that period in their career where they're accelerating their careers and getting promotions. So the long run rate of our rental growth would be 3 to 3.5%. We are delivering ahead of that at the moment in this obviously higher inflationary environment. So the other point about our business is we're extremely resilient with respect to changes in market conditions and inflationary times, because we have a natural hedge almost, if you like, against inflation within the business through inflation leading to wage growth, leading to rental growth. So from an earnings perspective, and with the platform benefits, just over the next 5 years, which we'd see as the medium term, we have the ability to grow our EPRA earnings, that's our rental-based earnings, by 50% over that time. And that, really what's driving that is our underlying organic rental growth of 3.5% plus. This is just looking at the committed pipeline where we're on site, which is actually only a third of that total pipeline we've talked about. And then the margin efficiencies, which I talked about earlier, which is really the scale benefits. And this is after absorbing higher interest costs as well as we're in a great financial position, by the way. We've locked down in fixed interest rates and we refinanced the business extensively a couple of years ago. So we're very well protected. But even as the fixing rolls off and rebasing to higher interest rates, we're still growing our earnings by 50%. So I don't think there's many real estate companies that can say that.
No, I don't think there is, Rob. So taking a bit of a step back now, looking at the macro picture, you did allude to it there. So I just want to pick up on that. Of course, investors are going to be looking at what's happening out there in the world and Donald Trump and his tariffs. You know, of course, you know, Grainger's not directly impacted by any of the trade tariffs, but there will be secondary effects on the UK property market and, of course, the rental market. You know, what's your assessment so far, Rob, of tariffs? What does it mean for Grainger going forward?
We look back over things like COVID, you know, which obviously was a huge distortion to the market. And, you know, we continue to pay our dividend and you know, our dividend has grown a huge amount over recent years. So we've been incredibly resilient in terms of our operational performance, our profitability, and our valuation of our assets as well, which again puts us quite distinct to the rest of the real estate sector and, you know, like commercial and offices and retail, which have seen quite significant declines in value. We've actually never really seen that. So at worst, our values fell just a few percent over this time. So we have been resilient. We always said we would be. And the reason for that is because of this natural inflation hedge in the business. So thinking about your question around Trump's tariffs and what the impact might be, we would expect to be certainly in a much more resilient position. Of course, we're not immune to any volatility in our market. And but interestingly, when you look at the underlying performance of the business, I think firstly, as a UK domestically focused business, then clearly we have a level of insulation with that. No one really knows where things are going to end up with tariffs, of course. And there's been a huge amount of volatility, you know, just on a daily basis at the moment. So, you know, it's difficult to predict ultimately where that will land. But I suppose there's a couple of scenarios that might play out. I mean, either some accommodation via trade deals will be reached and, you know, impacts will be more mooted, or, you know, there could be a more aggressive scenario which sustains inflation globally for some time. But that we've shown in the inflation situation that we've been very resilient because, you know, our business has performed very well over recent years, as I've touched on. You know, if growth in the economy slows ultimately through reduced trade, then again, we are incredibly, as a needs-based real estate sector, we are incredibly resilient because people ultimately do need a home over their head still. There is such a shortage. There's over a 4 million shortage in rental homes in the UK, and there's significant growth locked in the years ahead. So we are, you know, there's a huge housing shortage. There's a rental shortage, and the demographic trends are, you know, further growth in the years ahead. So, you know, this kind of chronic undersupply and strong demand means that we are, you know, we are incredibly resilient. So I would expect that should continue. That's not to say, you know, we'll be you know, completely immune from these effects, but we should certainly be at the much more resilient end. I hope that gives you a bit of a flavour. The other aspect, of course, in all of this is, you know, materials prices. So, you know, if indeed, you know, things like steel tariffs and so on cause an excess supply from the likes of China and everything else, it would be interesting to see what happens to construction costs, of course. You know, will we start to see these materials then being diverted to the UK, the UK actually being flooded with that and even, you know, potential deflationary impacts there. Then, of course, you know, that could be quite beneficial from a construction point of view.
Indeed, that's actually a really interesting and noteworthy point that you make there, that this could actually be a net benefit to the UK housing market if material prices do fall. So just want to touch on the dividend. You did mention it there, Rob, and you know, looking here, dividends increase each year over the last 10 years apart from the pandemic. Now, what does the dividend policy look like, and you know, the transition to a REIT, will that have any impact on the dividend at all?
So that is a great question. It's actually one that I get asked quite a lot. And the short answer is transitioning to a REIT, because we've always anticipated becoming a REIT, it's been almost a natural consequence, if you like, of our business strategy. Our dividend policy was always set to put us on a trajectory to pay out a dividend akin to what we would pay out as a REIT. So that means when we convert at the end of this financial year, ready for next, there'll be no significant step up or step down in the quantum of the dividend. So hopefully people will find that reassuring, and we will continue on a strong growth trajectory. And the reason for that is because our dividend going forwards, akin to other REITs, will be paid out of our EPRA earnings. And as I mentioned earlier, our EPRA earnings are locked in and growing by 50% over the next 5 years. So that will support a continued strong growth in our dividend going forwards. And we've had a really strong track record, as you say, of growing our income, growing our dividend, and we have clear visibility of that going forwards too. So we are a total return business. So we provide around a 3% yield today in terms of our in terms of our dividend, which will continue to grow, and then of course we have the growing valuations of the business, which are driven by obviously our strong consistent organic rental growth on top. So we expect to deliver a total accounting return, growth in valuation plus the dividends of the business, of around 8% a year, and that's a very low volatility tax efficient return. Because of the nature of our business, as we've touched on.
Thank you. So to summarise now, Robin, and look, most importantly, at the year ahead. From where you're sitting, what excites you the most about the year ahead for Grainger?
Oh, so many things. I think I'm so lucky to be the CFO of this business, which is a fantastic part of the market, and it's a really well run business with great people. And I think what particularly excites me is just the continuation of our growth agenda. Grainger is delivering, and we are going through this accelerating period of growth. So there's so much to look forward to in terms of the continued execution of that plan. We have a number of schemes opening. So later in the year, we have the next phase of our scheme in Bristol opening, which we're particularly excited about. Over the summer, we're extending to our cluster of properties in London, in Canning Town as well. And so there's a huge amount of momentum that we're going through. And more than anything, it's just the continued delivery of this really exciting path of growth that makes me want to get out of bed every morning and help the business drive its success.
Fantastic. Thank you. So, just as a note to listeners, do check out Grainger's website, as Rob mentioned. There's really in-depth analysis of the company, and you can also get quite a good look at their properties as well and get really good insights there. So Rob, thank you very much for being on the podcast today.
Thank you, Jonathan. It's been a real pleasure and lovely to speak with you.
And thank you very much to everyone for listening. Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed listening to the UK Investor Magazine podcast. Please do share the podcast, and we really value any reviews and comments you leave us in your chosen podcast player. The views presented by the hosts and guests of the UK Investor Magazine podcast are in no way investment advice, and please remember, all investment involves risk.